So I'm going to talk about joy today, and I'll start with a funeral. And we moved this study day to today rather than yesterday because we had a family funeral to go to in Wales. It was one of Casper's elderly uncles, who I'd only met a few times. So today, this weekend, we wore black yesterday and we've worn red today. It's been an interesting weekend. And I wanted to talk a little bit about my journey to the funeral in Wales and what happened when we got there. I have been somehow called to Ram Dass recently, the American spiritual teacher, and I'd uploaded one of his talks onto a little memory stick before we left, and we played that in the car as we went. And the landscape between here and Caersus, where the funeral was, is absolutely stunning. Rolling, the hills get more and more rolling, and the mist, and there was kind of drizzle, and it was all veiled with kind of white. And Ram Dass spoke in the car, and he speaks really slowly, and he spoke about spiritual experience and greed and different levels of consciousness, all kinds of things, and he spoke. It's like he was speaking directly into my heart. Words went right in and resonated. And I was streaming with tears. There was just something about what he was saying that was so true. And that was joy. And then we arrived at the funeral, and there was a minister who'd been friends with the man who died. For many years, and he spoke about how they used to take him round. He lived on his own. His family used to take him round a Sunday lunch on a plate, and all of his children would fight about who would be able to come and carry the plate because they liked him, because he was a good man. And he spoke so beautifully about this man that I didn't really know very well. And there were some of his Welsh friends were behind us in the church, and they sang a Welsh hymn just beautifully, and that was joy. And then it was time to put him in the ground, and we went to the graveyard and drove, and suddenly the weather kind of whipped up, and it was suddenly hail and wind, and we had to get out the car and walk along this lane to get to the grave, and there was just everything coming at us. It was all suddenly like a hurricane, and there was a hill behind, like a steep Welsh hill, and this little graveyard, and nobody could really see anything or hear anything. And the woman, who was saying ashes to ashes and dust to dust, you could see her mouth moving, but the sound was just gone. It's just absolutely gone. And I lost Casper, and this older woman and her grown up daughter had this huge golf umbrella, and they beckoned me over, and she put her arm around me. It makes me cry even saying it. I don't know who this woman was. She put her arm around me, kept me safe, and she was worried about whether the water was coming down my arm or not. And we stood and listened, and she just kept me safe under that umbrella. And then I left, and I'll probably never see her again, maybe at another funeral or another wedding. And that was joy. So, a funeral. And yet, those moments of joy. So, joy. There's a few things I want to think about this morning. What is joy? How do we know? Are there different types of joy? How do we get more of it? Why should we feel joyful? And I've got a few texts from various Buddhist texts that I'll refer to. I'm speaking mostly as Satya and partly as a Buddhist and partly as a Pure Land Buddhist and partly as Satcha as a Pure Land Buddhist, if that makes any sense. So I'm not speaking for Buddhists or anyone. When I became Satchavani, when I left my life as Fiona behind, I took 135-ish precepts, which are more. Yeah, those are the ones I didn't want to think about, those extra ones. And each of these precepts is not something that I'm expected to stick to 100%, but something that's something to head towards. So I try and point myself towards these precepts in the general direction. And there's a whole section, this is my favourite section, on joy in the practice. So I thought I'd start by reading those to you. So on joy in the practice, number 40 is my favourite precept ever, which is to rejoice. 41, to have faith that brings joy to others, like those described in the 44th vow. 42, to stand in awe. 43, to rejoice with others. 44, to rejoice for the successes of others. And 45, to be conscientious and live such that one's life declares the Dharma. So I'll hopefully remember to return to those at the end. They feel important. So it feels like a huge topic, joy, and I've been sitting with it over the past few weeks that I've known that I'll be talking to you today. And I've been thinking about my own experience of what joy is, how it works for me. And I think probably the most important thing is that I can't contrive it. I can't manufacture it. Even though I would dearly like to, because we all want more joy. And I think that if there's one thing that I wanted to say this morning, I guess it's that I think we probably all get ourselves into a lot of trouble trying to seek joy and trying to hold on to joy when we get it. Like, as soon as we get some, we want more. And Ram Dass was speaking yesterday about how we don't just want more, we want more and more and more. And then we get a little bit more and we want a little bit more, and then we get a little bit more and we want a little bit more. So there's something endless about that. And I thought I'd start with a reading from as close to the Buddha's own voice as we can get, I guess, which is a reading from the collection, which is the Digha Nikaya, which is one of the collections of the discourses of the Buddha. And I've been reading this. I've been slowly working my way through this, feeling like a good Buddhist. Should read the Nikayas. And this particular story that I found that mentions joy in it is quite an amusing one. It's called A God Consults the Buddha. The Sakapanha Sutta. I don't know if that's pronounced right or not. And 33 gods, a head god and 33 of his friends come down to talk to the Buddha. It explains in the back that although he's a god, he's actually way below Brahma. So he's actually quite a lowly god. And he brings this chap along with him who plays the lute. And this chap, man, this is completely irrelevant to joy, but I thought it was funny. This chap plays his lute and sings a love song to tempt the Buddha out of his meditation and to tempt him to come and give them some wisdom. And part of this story, so it's all about this lady who causes him heart's delight, And there's a bit in it that says, "Come embrace me, maiden fair of thighs. Season, hold me with your lovely eyes." And there's a little note and it says the previous translator left that bit out about the thighs. That was a bit much for him. So anyway, the Buddha does come out. He's tempted by this song, which the translator again says is quite unusual for the Buddha to be tempted out by this love song. And they enter a conversation about, you know, what's how to live well, how to live a good life. And at one point he starts talking about, you know, what gets in the way of living well. And the Buddha says, well, you know, things like hate, harming, hostility, jealousy, greed. And then he says, well, what, where does that come from? And the Buddha says, blah, blah, blah. And he says, well, where does that come from? Blah, blah, blah. And they end up with the tendency to proliferation, which I think is where your mind just kind of gets a bit lost and gets all sort of full. So then at this point, the gods ask, well, sir, so they're talking to Shakyamuni Buddha, well, sir, what practice has that monk undertaken who has reached the right way, which is needful and leading to the cessation of the tendency to proliferation? And then Shakyamuni says, ruler of the gods, I declare that there are two kinds of happiness, the kind to be pursued and the kind to be avoided. The same applies to unhappiness and equanimity. Why have I declared this in regard to happiness? This is how I understood happiness. When I observed that in the pursuit of such happiness, unwholesome factors increased and wholesome factors decreased, then that happiness was to be avoided. And when I observed the pursuit of such happiness, unwholesome factors decreased and wholesome ones increased, then that happiness was to be sought after. Now, of such happiness as is accompanied by thinking and pondering, and of that which is not so accompanied, the latter is the more excellent. The same applies to unhappiness and to equanimity. And this, ruler of gods, is the practice that monk has undertaken who has reached the right way, leading to the cessation of the tendency to proliferation. And Saka, who's the ruler of the gods, expressed his delight at the Lord's answer. So I think that little nugget that the Buddha has told us is a really nice way of thinking about telling the difference between when we're seeking something that we think is happiness or that we think it's good happiness, but actually it doesn't really take us to a good place. So I guess a small example would be when I got home last night, I thought, well, what's really going to make me happy is a big roast dinner and a chocolate brownie. And so we had a big roast dinner and a chocolate brownie. And that's fine. That's all very well. But if I then thought, I'm going to be even more happy if I have another chocolate brownie, and then ate that, and then thought, I'm even more happy if I have another chocolate brownie, then I imagine that an unwholesome factor would increase. That might be greed. That might be thinking of myself rather than other people. That might be feeling a little bit sick. I'm sure that's an unwholesome factor. Whereas if I think, oh, I really want to remember to give Izzy her little Buddha because I think it might make her happy. And that would make me happy. And then I give it and it does make her happy. And then I feel happy. I think that has increased my wholesome factors because it's something about generosity. Or, but then if I think, oh, it made her happy, I like that, I might give her another one, or I might spend more money and give everyone a present, because then I can feel really good about myself. Then it's tipped. It's kind of tipped over into something which is no longer about something wholesome. And I think I like the word wholesome. I think it's quite one that we can all resonate with in terms of food, or, you know, in terms of activities that are wholesome or unwholesome. I also like the fact that the Buddha in this little section at least is saying that actually it's okay to pursue happiness which leads to wholesome factors increasing, because he doesn't usually talk about that kind of thing. It's usually, well, we just need to just, you know, not pursue anything. And but that wasn't how he lived his life. You know, he did go around doing lots of good things, and I think he was a pretty happy chap. So that reassures me, that's because it feels like it's okay. It's okay to want a roast dinner and to enjoy a roast dinner. And that, you know, if, as long as we're not getting caught up in something. So that's the first little bit. And then I found something else in Shantideva. Shantideva's writing. Shantideva was an 8th century Buddhist master in India. You might know his book. So he wrote Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And this is a translation by Geshe Kelsang Gyatso, which is a nice translation. He has written something that's sort of similar to what I was talking about just now. And he's talking about how to be a bodhisattva. And he says, like a bodhisattva, I should long to work for others with the same enthusiasm as that possessed by someone who thoroughly enjoys playing a game. I should never tire, but experience uninterrupted joy. Although it is uncertain whether the result will be happiness or suffering, worldly people still work hard to make themselves happy. So why do we not derive joy from the practice of Dharma, which definitely results in happiness? I have a strong wish to pursue objects of desire, which, like honey on a razor's edge, give no real satisfaction. But it would be far better to develop a strong will to pursue virtuous actions, which result in the everlasting happiness of liberation from all suffering. There's a couple of things in this that I like. The first is in the first stanza, which is he's already talking about working for others, which is the whole point of being a bodhisattva. But he's talking about how we should do that, I think. And we should work for others with the same enthusiasm as that possessed by someone who thoroughly enjoys playing a game. And when I think about that, I think about, it doesn't actually matter what happens next. It doesn't matter whether that person that you're helping is appreciative, or whether they don't even know you've done anything, or whether they actually say, that's really not helped me at all, you're a terrible person, because you've enjoyed the act of giving or the act of working or whatever it is, as if it were a game. So there's a sort of a joy in that, that you don't need anything extra. And that is a good thing, because it puts us in a position where we're not dependent on the other person for anything in return. And I think there's nothing worse than receiving something from someone that you know is going to call that favour in at a particular point, or they're going to resent it until you do something back, or they're going to, there's something left, or they really need you. I, someone who will remain nameless just in case they ever listen to this, is very bad at receiving Christmas presents. They really need to have a present they like. So there's something about not being able to just receive it. there's a kind of a, there's something that's demanded of you when you give the present. You need to get it right. That's probably a bad example, but it's, there's something cleaner about not being, our ego's not being dependent on anything, getting anything in return. So that's the first thing I think he's talking about. I also really love this bit about what we all have, which is a need to pursue desire. He says, I have a strong wish to pursue objects of desire. So Shantideva's coming clean there. He's like everybody else. And then he says, it's like honey on a razor's edge and it gives no satisfaction. I just think that image is amazing. And you can just sort of imagine, can't you, trying to kind of lick off the honey and you get a bit of sweetness, but it's dangerous. It's dangerous because you're falling into the trap of thinking that you can control how much honey you get. And it gets you into trouble. It gets you into trouble. And he says, it would be far better to develop a strong wish to pursue virtuous actions, not will, as I read before, I typed it wrong, which would result in the everlasting happiness of liberation from all suffering. So the message here is where it's really at, where satisfaction and lasting joy is really at, is when we're offering something to others. And that is something that makes us happy. So I don't know how your own experience of that has been, but that definitely rings true for me. What I don't like about that is that I'm not in control of it. I like to be in control. And it's not about me deciding what I want when I want it, which is much nicer. It's quite radical to really acknowledge that we can't get what we want when we want it, however cleverly we try and manipulate things or events or people or so there's something about giving that up, I guess. And he's saying, you know, worldly people still work hard to make themselves happy. We work bloody hard. So why do we not just derive joy from the practice of the Dharma, which definitely results in happiness? That's what he says. Don't even bother trying to eat three brownies to get there. That's just not going to work. So we started thinking about what joy was. And I told you the story of how I received three joyful moments or series of moments yesterday. And we talked about what Shakyamuni thought about how to tell the difference between the different kinds of joy or happiness. And then Shantideva has added something in about the importance of offering to others and the foolishness of trying to lick the honey from the edge of the razor. I also wanted to say something about the disappointments of worldly joy and how we can mitigate the effects of that disappointment, or how we can take refuge in something that's bigger than that. Because the world is such that a lot of the time we might be helping others, or we might be preoccupied with things that aren't about getting what we want, and we don't get much joy at all. We can have days or weeks or months that are dark, difficult. People let us down. We do something good. The other person is horrible to us. That's how life is. That's how human beings are. And I wanted to turn to a more Pure Land approach or understanding of that. And it's in one of my favourite books. I'll give you these later, which I've got some writing on them. Did I just take that out of the place where I needed to read the quote from? That's okay, because I've got it here. And this book by John Paraskevopoulos, it's called Call of the Infinite, The Way of Shin Buddhism. And he talks a lot about very Pure Land concepts and Amida. And I'll read you this section just because I think it's really beautiful. So, the light of Amida pervades our lives, even when we are in the throes of the most dire passions. As precious as they are to us, our human joys and loves, while partaking something of the blissfulness of Nirvana, for they can have no other origin, cannot fully meet our deepest human need to be unconditionally embraced and accepted, which is precisely what Amida vows to do for all beings. And then he quotes Shandao, sentient beings who solely think on Amida Buddha are constantly illuminated by the light of that Buddha's heart, grasped and protected, never to be abandoned. And then he goes on, in this way, we are able to derive profound consolation. Thank you, Roshi. From the fact that in moments of either exhilaration or sadness, the Buddha's beneficent presence is available to us at all times. When our desires are frustrated or thwarted, we can take refuge in the infinite light that nurtured them in the first place, that lit them from within, and which also carries us beyond them. Even when all the things the world can give are irretrievably wrenched from us, we will always have this light shining in our hearts. This can never be taken away. I have an experience of this, and it comes and goes. It's not always strong, but I have an experience that even when I feel utterly hopeless, even when joy is, you know, the last thing that I'm thinking about, I am somehow held by something that is loving and compassionate. And it's very hard to be upstaged by a cat. This is the kind of moment that I'm talking about, that I have to turn to Amida. And that we can know that is there. Whatever else is happening in our life, however good a day we're having, however bad a day we're having, that is there, sort of holding us safe. So I'll finish with a quote by Dogen. Thought I'd get some Zen, some Pure Land, some all kinds of different Buddhism in. And I just like this quote. The life of one day is enough to rejoice. Even though you live for just one day, if you can be awakened, that one day is vastly superior to one endless life of sleep. If this day is the lifetime of 100 years is lost, will you ever touch it with your hands again? And I think that I like what Casper said about merit at the service on Wednesday night, that one way of describing merit, the merit we sort of accumulate and then offer to others, is happy mind. And this is something that Dharmavijja said at some point, that what we're really doing when we practice our Buddhist practice or whatever spiritual practice we're doing is accumulating happiness, accumulating joy, living in a way that means that we allow more joy in. We allow the grace of joy to come in, that we're building it all up and we're getting more and more shiny and happy. And then we can pass that on. We can let go of it. We can offer it to other people. Because if we hold on to it, it just rots. It doesn't work like that, unfortunately. You only keep getting more of it if you give it away. I hope I've shared a little bit of joy with you today. Roshi will take over where I leave off, and we also have cake. Yeah. So thank you very much for your attention, and we'll pause there. Namo Amida Buddha.